This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. State lawmakers ended the session this month without passing legislation aimed at reducing teen vaping. Health officials are concerned that the use of flavored e-cigarettes are on the rise among younger teens. But it appears there may be some action at the federal level. HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us about an effort to raise the national smoking age to 21.
When I first started vaping, I just turned 15 years old.
It's a normal thing to do. I was 13 the first time I vaped.
These kids from a tobacco-free California ad are part of the estimated 37% of 12th graders nationwide that tried vaping last year. That's according to the National Institutes of Health. While the use of conventional tobacco products has been declining nationwide, rates of vaping and e-cigarette use have been rising rapidly in recent years, especially amongst teens. That has some members of Congress looking for a way to curb the trend.
Tobacco is the leading cause of preventable death in the United States.
Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz introduced a proposal to increase the nationwide smoking age to 21. Currently, 13 states have enacted or passed similar laws. Hawaii was the first to do so back in 2016.
One of the best ways we can stop tobacco use is by increasing the legal smoking age. According to the National Academy of Medicine, raising the legal age to 21 would save more than 220,000 lives. Our bill is clean, it is simple, it is free of loopholes, and it is bipartisan.
The bipartisan support came from Senators Mitt Romney of Utah and Todd Young of Indiana. Senator Young says there will be more than just health benefits from raising the age.
95% of Americans begin using tobacco before age 21. If we can raise the age of purchase, we can significantly reduce the number of people who begin using this product. Moreover, the cost on society for healthcare associated with tobacco use is roughly $300 billion per year. We have an opportunity to significantly reduce public expenditures in this area.
The proposal would not tackle issues like online sales or flavored vaping products. But Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin says those flavors have, quote, got to go.
Let me read some of those flavors to you so you can be the judge as to whether this is going to have an impact on adults. The flavors include fruit medley, gummy bears, cotton candy, fruity hoops, marshmallow, mom's custard, and s'mores galore. Does that sound like something that's designed for children or adults? I think it's clear.
The action in Congress is in contrast to what happened at the Hawaii State Capitol this year, where proposals to restrict youth vaping largely failed to get traction. The effort was spearheaded by the Hawaii Public Health Institute. Jessica Yamauchi is the institute's executive director. I sat down with her to get a recap of what happened.
Relating to tobacco, we really had two initiatives that we were pushing this year. One was a regulation bill that was going to establish a tax on e-cigarettes, require a tobacco permit and license be pulled for ESD retailers and wholesalers, and to restrict online shipping of e-cigarettes and other tobacco products. That was all in one bill. The other bill was going to prohibit the sale of flavored tobacco products.
And how did those two ideas do at the legislature?
Unfortunately, neither of them ended up passing this year. So the flavor ban that we were working on went all the way until the Finance Committee, and the Finance Committee did hear it, which we were very happy to have a hearing there. Unfortunately, though, they decided to defer the bill. And so at that point, the bill died. For the regulation bill, the bill number actually passed, but all of those regulations that I mentioned that we were trying to get passed did not pass. Instead, different language around e-cigarettes and the issue was inserted into the bill. And so what ended up passing is the Department of Health establishing a safe harbor for people under 21 to drop off their e-cigarettes, for schools to be able to confiscate them, and increasing the youth penalty. So youth would be, youth under the age of 21 caught would be fined $100.
So not a whole lot on the prevention side, it sounds like.
Correct. And really nothing that helps to regulate the industry itself, right? It's all being put on the user now.
Where do we stand, generally speaking, with either tobacco use or more specifically vaping and e-cigarettes in Hawaii?
Well, we had tremendous progress with tobacco use and with cigarettes. Unfortunately, with e-cigarettes, we really have been towards the top usage rates in the country. And so, you know, we've got 25.5% of our high school students that regularly use. And on our neighbor islands, we know that the rates are even higher than they are on Oahu. And so it's really concerning, as we know that this is a whole new generation that's getting addicted to nicotine.
What were, did you get any reasoning from lawmakers who decided not to pursue the legislation that you had been in favor of?
No, I think when the flavor ban died in the finance committee, the finance chair did mention that they felt that other regulations needed to pass before a flavor ban could be effective, specifically online restrictions really needed to be passed before a flavor ban could be effectively implemented. So the other bill, though, that did have the online restrictions in it, unfortunately, what ended up passing didn't have that regulation in it. So we're still faced with needing some of those industry regulations here.
What is the current slate of regulations in Hawaii?
So they are included in our Tobacco 21 law. So you have to be 21 to purchase or to sell e-cigarettes. They are included in our smoke-free workplace law. So anywhere that it's prohibited for you to smoke indoors, it includes e-cigarettes. But really, that's about the extent. Last year, they did set up a registration process with the Attorney General's office. So instead of requiring them to pull a tobacco permit and license, which is issued through the Department of Taxation, which is what all other tobacco retailers and wholesalers have to do, they set up a separate registration process in the Attorney General's office. At the time, I think that that was done really because the legislature wasn't ready to tax the e-cigarettes. And when the permanent license is issued by the Department of Taxation, they're primarily doing that to ensure that the taxes are being collected on those products.
And they can still be purchased over the internet in Hawaii?
Currently, yes. So cigarettes cannot be. That's actually a federal law. But other tobacco products and e-cigarettes are available online.
There was just a proposal announced by Senator Brian Schatz and several of his fellow members of Congress to institute a nationwide 21 and older requirement to purchase tobacco and to use tobacco. Here in Hawaii, we've had that in place for a few years now.
We have. And I think, you know, as far as we know, we don't have a lot of data yet. It went into effect January 1, 2016. But we do know that, compliance is pretty good with the stores. There are some stores, though, that have been cited. One of the things that was difficult is we don't have a great database of everybody selling e-cigarettes. And so making sure that compliance checks are happening with everybody selling e-cigarettes has been a little bit more challenging. The Attorney General registration that was required last year just kind of started going into effect last fall. And so we're hoping that that will help produce a more robust database for e-cigarettes, so we can just ensure that we are working on ensuring compliance with all of, not just the tobacco stores, but the e-cigarettes.
So still too a little bit too early to tell on the 21 law.
Yeah, and again, I think, you know, we have seen for sure continued decline in tobacco use rates, but it's the e-cigarettes that we know that people are finding loopholes to purchase because our youth rates are really high.
Why do you think that is? Why are those two means of consuming nicotine moving in opposite directions, trend-wise?
Well, I mean, I think the work over decades on tobacco and cigarette issues has really paid off. I think that the restrictions that have been in place for so long on cigarettes has paid off. And the e-cigarette industry was so far ahead of the game from us. And so although restrictions are starting to go into place, they had 6-7 years of marketing these without any kind of regulation. And really, there's very little regulation that still exists. And so, you know, you see television advertisements for these. When's the last time you saw a television ad for a cigarette, right? Mm-hmm. So they're marketing them. They have a lot less restrictions. You have no flavored cigarettes anymore. There's over 15,000 flavors of e-cigarettes.
And I just realized we never actually talked about the health impacts of this activity. Everybody kind of knows what risk you're running by smoking a cigarette. Do we have data on what health effects are associated with e-cigarette use?
I feel like every day there's more and more studies that are coming out. And that's one reason the industry had such a head start, too, though, is many of the organizations like American Heart Association, American Cancer Society, they really have to wait until there's some scientific data. And that's what we're seeing come out. You know, they definitely have a lot of the same impacts. Long-term data is still going to take a while to catch up, obviously. But we do know the other scary thing that's happening is students put other things in their e-cigarette. It can sometimes just be a device that they're then putting other types of chemicals in or drugs in. And so that's dangerous as well.
All right, Jessica, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jessica Yamauchi is the executive director of the Hawaii Public Health Institute. We'll have a link to Senator Brian Schatz's Tobacco Aged 21 Act posted with the story on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, it's that time of year when exhausted but excited college seniors across the country turn in their theses. We've got a great group sharing their labors of love. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. The story behind today's backyard quiz begins with an extinct bird species endemic to the Big Island called the mamo. Mamo were small black honey creepers with curved beaks, which helped them feed on nectar. But not all of their feathers were black. Each mamo had from 6 to 8 gold-yellow feathers tucked behind its wings, and they were considered extremely valuable to Native Hawaiians. For Native Hawaiians, feathers were more than just beautiful. They symbolized rank and a connection to the gods. One of the most famous feather pieces is the cape of King Kamehameha I. 12 feet wide at its base and weighing 6 pounds, it was valued by the art critic J.J. Jarvis at $1 million in the mid-1800s. The cape is composed entirely of feathers, mostly the beautiful golden mamo feathers. Can you guess how many feathers are in that cape? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. You may know them as white terns or fairy terns. The protected Hawaiian seabird, or the Manu'oku, is being honored this weekend. A festival celebrating the official bird of our city takes place on the grounds of Iolani Palace on Saturday. Take a listen to its raspy call. Thank you. The seabirds are generally only found here on Oahu, and they don't build nests in the traditional sense. Last spring, one laid an egg on a railing at a downtown building, which forced the shutdown of a construction project. The white birds have eyes ringed in black, and they have sharp, pointy beaks. They also have forked tails. We sat down with Joni Peters, the operations manager for the Hawaii Conservation Council, to fully appreciate this little city-dwelling seabird.
What's so unusual about them is that they pair for life, and both parents take care of their chicks and the eggs, which is kind of unusual sometimes. And they do lay their eggs without a nest on a branch.
So it just wherever, whenever they feel like having an egg, they're going to lay an egg.
Yes.
And so this is our official bird of Honolulu, correct?
Correct. City and County of Honolulu, correct.
And so a lot of times folks will be walking around town and they'll see these blue ribbons or blue bands around trees.
Correct. And they indicate that there is an active chick or egg in the tree. And that also warns the tree trimmers to be careful. Do not, you know, because there is an active family on that tree. So
now, is this a bird endangered or threatened in any way?
No.
It's not.
No, but the one nice thing about this bird, because it is in Honolulu proper, that anybody can see a native bird. Whereas all of our other native birds, you would probably have to hike out to see. But anyone can see this bird because the habitation is on Oahu for the main islands and particularly in downtown. So from Aina Haina all the way out to Ford Island is where we see them. They're concentrated in downtown Honolulu. There's a lot in University of Hawaii on the campus. And so it's like an ambassador. The manuku is an ambassador bird for anyone to see a native bird. And that's so thrilling, you know, and that's why we made this Manu'oku Festival, to have people recognize that there is a native bird that they can see every day.
Are they partial to any particular trees?
No, not at all. But they like a lot, when I see them, they like a lot of coverage, so they won't go on bare trees. I see them mostly on trees with a lot of, you know, foliage.
I see them at Kapi'olani Park, in the monkey pod trees.
Mm-hmm.
I see them at Iolani Palace.
Mm-hmm.
At Iolani Palace, there are those parrots. I've seen schools of parrots, and those aren't native birds.
Those are not native birds. They don't fare well when there are a lot of those green parrots.
Yeah, because they're an introduced species.
Correct, and they're very territorial, the green parrots.
Ah, so maybe then they've displaced a family of manuku.
Correct. Yeah.
Well, and what do they eat? What do they like to feast on?
Fish. So they don't go far to find their fish. And that's why historically it's really important to Hawaiians, the manuku bird, because a lot of times when the canoes come in, especially like the hokulea, when they see the manu'oku far off, they know they're near land because the manu'oku do not go far to get food out in the ocean.
Oh, interesting. Yes. And then are they partial to any particular types of fish?
That I'm not sure. Yeah.
So if they saw some fish at the state capitol in the reflecting ponds.
No, I think they'll get the small little fishes, you know, like sardine-sized fish. Yeah, because they're primarily a smaller bird. Yeah.
Okay. I know I've seen too an increase in the number of those egrets, those other white birds.
Oh, those
town.
Other white birds.
But those
yes.
are not from here.
No, they're not.
And same thing. Are they territorial? Or do they compete with the same, you know, food? Maybe.
No.
Not so much then.
Not so much with the manu'oku. No.
Why did you folks decide that we needed to have a festival celebrating the white tern?
Because no one knew that this manu'oku was a native bird. They've always been mistaken for pigeons, white doves, and they're such a beautiful bird that we just wanted to make people aware that there are native birds that you can see right in downtown Honolulu. right in the urban core. We don't have that here in Hawaii especially. So we wanted to make this festival and educate the public on this bird that they can see going to work or go shopping when they visit the Capitol or go to Iolani Palace or just driving by. They're very acrobatic when they fly, and they're always there. Every day I see them on my way to work.
And then are there certain things that you're doing in the school, I don't know, just to educate the kids about this bird?
Not yet. We are looking towards that down in the future. But for right now, we're just doing the festival. And we are alerting people that, you know, bring your families. It's free and it's open to the public. We have a lot of activities. We have a halau coming in. We have a costume contest. We have Ranger Rick from National Wildlife Federation, a costumed Ranger Rick coming. And, you know, we have a lot of fun.
We just want to celebrate, celebrate our turn. How many years have you been doing this festival?
This is our fourth year. When we first started, it was very small, and now we've grown a lot, and we have a lot of partners coming out to help us educate the public through games, activities, and little things that teach the kids about conservation, you know, about plastics and, you know, different things that they can help not only the Manuoku, but the environment as well.
And so tell us about the Conservation Council and its mission.
Well, the Conservation Council is one of the oldest, it is the oldest nonprofit environmental organization in the state. We were founded in 1950, so next year will be our 70th anniversary. And we're here to primarily be a spokesperson for the native wildlife here in Hawaii and to see it continue for the future generations. You know, we're losing a lot of species. If Hawaii is not the species capital of the world, it certainly is of the United States. And so we like to try and hang on to what we have. And so Conservation Council does that through primarily education and policy work. We do every couple of years make a wildlife poster, and we send it out to every school in the state, private, public, and immersion schools. And we do a lot of work and networking with all the rest of the environmental organizations.
Okay. Yeah. So, but basically then the putting on this festival is just part of that outreach to the community.
Correct.
And
correct.
Education.
Yes.
Okay.
It's part of our education piece.
Anything else? Any other White Tern stories that you can share with us? I mean, we had the one the egg that was laid on the railing, which shut down a construction project.
Mm-hmm.
Any others?
Yes, you know, so around town, people are being aware of the Manuoku from the festival. And we get a lot of calls quite often of downed chicks. So people will call us. I would in turn call Hui Manuoku to come out. And they actually come out with a little stick that has a little pedestal. And they kind of nudge that little chick to hop on that pedestal, and just it's a pole, so it's like, think of a fruit picker with a little pedestal on, and they would raise that chick to where it was, and they kind of nudge that pole so that chick will hop off right where they were before they fell off.
Okay, so back into their nest or
yes.
In their safe zone.
Right.
So that way they don't have to handle the chick.
Yes. Yes, and I find that so encouraging that the public now call us or call Hui Manuoku because they see a down chick.
The Manuoku Festival happens at Iolani Palace this Saturday from 11 to 3. For more details, check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hoi mai ka manuoku, hoi I ka pūnana e, ku e, ku e, ku e, ku e. Hoi mai ka manuoku, he
manu ke o ke o I ka ina ku e he manu li ili I I ka mo ana ho ai lona no ka pa a hoku le a I ke ana I ka moku o ka pa ki pika he manu ke o ke o I ka ina ku e he manu li ili I ka mo ana.
Well, the National Weather Service is set to give their forecasts for the 2019 hurricane season next week, but the islands have yet to fully recover from last year's storms. The release of federal aid, disaster aid, is the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Marcel Henri on the line today. Morning.
Hey, Catherine. Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday. So, yeah, we just got word that we're going to get a bunch of federal aid disaster money, right?
Right. It's kind of the latest tranche. This is $67 million in additional funding for disaster recovery in the islands, particularly for the 2018 disasters, that whole spate that we endured from the Kilauea eruption to the storms that caused catastrophic flooding on Kauai and East Oahu, and of course, Hurricane Lane and the tropical storms. It was a very busy 2018. And so that puts it the total up to $429 million in federal funding. And when you add the $200 million in state funding for those various disasters, you are now well over $500 million just to deal with 2018.
The federal money, though, that's reimbursed, right? Is that how that works?
Yeah, I believe some of it is reimbursement based.
Okay. And so, gosh, I mean, as far as processing these things, I mean, I know that they were looking at trying to get more state positions to help work through the FEMA paperwork, because it's a lot of red tape, I think.
Certainly a lot of red tape. I do know that the $67 million, that is coming out of community development block grants that's issued through Housing and Urban Development, and this is specifically their disaster recovery program. So that will be administered through the states and through the county. It'll have to funnel through those local government bureaucracies.
Right. And I know, as we mentioned, NOAA's going to be releasing the information on how they think we're going to shape up this year for storms. That new term that just blows me away is rain bombs, because that was in my vocabulary, I think, until last year.
I agree. That's kind of a new thing that's unfortunately come onto the scene. You'll hear it more. I was listening to Chip Fletcher over at UH, I want to say a couple of months ago, and he was giving a presentation that shows as the effects of climate change intensify worldwide, you're going to see more of these quote-unquote rain bombs, and that's basically what Kauai experienced, and, East Oahu, Aina Haina got a dash of that as well.
We're talking about federal funding, but I want to segue to rail, because I know you cover those meetings regularly, and they've got a meeting this week, and they're talking about birds, which I thought was interesting.
It was kind of a quirky item that I'll check on when this meeting occurs on Thursday. The board is going to consider $1.4 million for vector control. Basically, what's going on is there are a lot of rogue pigeons and also seabirds and invasive owls, apparently, that are nesting and roosting in the kind of the cavities of the guideway that's been built so far, anywhere between 12 and 15 miles, right, from Kapolei all the way to the airport. And apparently they're leaving so much guano, which is basically the droppings, right? It's gotten so bad that it now constitutes a health hazard. And so they need to create some kind of a program where they're going to install nets and possibly even spikes where the stations are going to be to get this under control as construction resumes. That's to the cost of $1.4 million. So the birds are frankly making really good use of the guideway so far.
Well, we've been talking a lot about birds on this program this morning, but I was intrigued because the article that I saw posted online at Civil Beat talks about how back in, 2011, that this was flagged as a potential problem.
Yeah, apparently they knew that this was going to be an issue. They just never budgeted the funding for it. They've advanced along, and lo and behold, here we are with almost two-thirds of the guideway constructed. And the birds have made themselves at home inside of it. So now they're catching up. The $1.4 million will go towards design work as well as installation of whatever vector control system they do. That's across the full span of the guideway, the ultimately what they hope will be 20 miles of guideway.
Now, I don't recall attending that meeting where they talked about this issue back in 2011, but yeah, I can see how, gosh, that was, you know, 8 years ago, right? So that's a lot of bird droppings.
Well, you know, they didn't start building the guideway, I want to say, until roughly 2012. And, you know, really kind of, yeah, in earnest, it's really picked up in, I want to say, the last 5 years or so. And so, yeah, a lot of the issue right now is Waipahu, West Oahu, Farrington Highway. You know, they included photos in a presentation that's going to go before the board on Thursday. And if you go on HART's website, you can click in on it. Actually, there's a link on our website as well, and you can see kind of the illustrations of the vast amounts of yes. bird poop that are populating the inside of the guideway.
Yes, I did happen to catch that. So a picture's worth a thousand words.
Right,
thanks so
right.
much, Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henri with today's Reality Check. Check out the latest news on civilbeat.org.
A lot of people are excited that I mentioned on the air yesterday that I'll be on Fresh Air with Terry Gross on NPR.
It happened. I recorded an interview with Howard Stern, and there was so much to talk about, we've made it a two-parter. You can hear part one on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 2, right after On Point. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Opera Theater, presenting Verdi's story of ill-fated love, La Traviata, featuring Hawaii's Quinn Kelsey, opening this Friday at the Blaisdell. HawaiiOperaTheater.com.
Following a recent call-in show on vaccinations, we heard different perspectives from across the community. We start off with Joe from Hawaii Island.
I listened to your vaccination discussion and found it profoundly one-sided, disseminating pro-vaccination misinformation with no background research into the scientific case for questioning vaccination, such as the conflicts of interest that exist within the CDC, which has led to dissemination of misinformation by the CDC regarding vaccination safety, failure to publish, and reportedly destruction of negative vaccine studies, a revolving door between the regulating agency and the industry it is supposed to be regulating. The unbiased Institute of Medicine's repeated studies that show that there is not adequate study to confirm the safety of vaccinations, the failure of the public health and medical community in Hawaii to meet statutory requirements for informed consent with regard to vaccination, and finally, the continuous real disrespect for the concept of informed consent and the right to make that decision is continually being infringed upon nationwide and within the state of Hawaii. And it's unfortunate to hear such a one-sided conversation. Thank you for your time.
I live on the Big Island, and my comment is I'm a grandmother, and my daughter-in-law will not immunize her 4-year-old child. And with the measles outbreak, of course, I'm nervous about this. He'll be in kindergarten next year, and they want to send him to either a public school or a public charter school. So if I could persuade her to immunize him for some things, what would be the most important, and what would be the schedule since he's never been immunized for anything? Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Stacy, and I'm from Honolulu, and I just wanted to say thank you so much for airing this show on vaccines. I have a new baby, and I really appreciate that knowledge being shared, because there seems to be so much misinformation in town about this issue.
And we continue to hear feedback following our Gold Star License ID show. Patty from Molokai shared her husband's experience.
My husband, who is Hawaiian and had an original Territory of Hawaii birth certificate, got all his paperwork together, walked down to the DMV to renew his driver's license, and was turned away. He was told that his original Territory of Hawaii birth certificate was not valid and that he needed to apply for a State of Hawaii birth certificate. Just to let people know, in case they have that same issue, that it won't be accepted. Aloha.
And thanks for the letters. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Twitter or Facebook, or call our talkback line 792-8217. Earlier in today's show, we talked about the mamo, an extinct species of bird native to the Big Island. Avian malaria and the impact of Western contact drove it to extinction, but we do have remnants of its existence. Most of the mamo feathers were black, but each bird produced 6 or 8 golden feathers. They were highly valuable to Native Hawaiians. King Kamehameha I's cape was almost entirely constructed of them. Weighing it at 6 pounds, the cape was pretty hefty. And today we asked you to guess how many mamo feathers were on it. At only 6 to 8 feathers per bird, almost 80,000 mamo were caught. Some stories say they weren't killed after plucking. So if you've already done a quick calculation, you know it took at least 450,000 feathers to make Kamehameha the Great's cape. And congratulations to Martha from the Big Island. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Marcus Feigle is a rock nerd. He sat down with us to talk about the club he belongs to, the Hawaiian Rock and Mineral Society, which is being showcased next week at the Ohanahale Marketplace on Ward Avenue.
The Rock and Mineral Society of Hawaii, or Hui Pohako o Hawaii, is actually now 50 years old, and we have quite a few members. And to be honest, I'm not really sure how many. I think we have almost 100, maybe even more. But we have a group of, let's say, 3 or 4 dozen that come to meetings once a month regularly, and always sort of sometimes 15, sometimes 25 people at any given time.
So you have a lot of rock nerds.
We have quite a few, yes. And we feel very comfortable with each other because we share this passion for rocks and minerals and gemstones.
And people may not know that you actually have a place where people can go to cut stone.
Yes, we meet every 4th Wednesday of the month. That's the 4th Wednesday. Like in a month like this one where we have 5 Wednesdays, it's still the 4th. It's not the last Wednesday of the month. And then we have a short meeting, and then we have a show and tell because we always have a mineral of the month. And then the Rock and Mineral Society also runs a lapidary, which is machinery where you can cut and polish stones. And that's one of the added benefits of the club membership, as is that we organize rock and mineral shows 1 or 2 or 3 a year.
And
in Honolulu.
So tell us, I mean, what is it about rocks and minerals that grabs you?
That's a really good question, and I always blame my grandmother for it because she probably had a lot of rocks and minerals, and probably got interested when I was 5 or 6 years old, thinking back. And then I had the great advantage that when I was a kid from 10 to 13, I lived in Brazil, and Brazil is a mineral collector's paradise. And at the time when I went to the flea market, I could buy things for whatever would nowadays would be the equivalent of a buck. that I have no idea how I got this because the markets were just full with the most beautiful stones you can ever imagine.
And so what about living here in Hawaii? I mean, are there places you can go dig for cool stuff?
Well, Hawaii is a beautiful island. It's one of the most beautiful spots in the universe. That's why we all live here. We have very beautiful orchids, but we don't have very many minerals, no. If you're interested in lava, green, gray, yellow, black, we have lots of it. And we have a few selenite crystals, which you can find on this island. We have augite crystals at Coco Head, which are probably, if they're really, really, really big, a quarter inch big. And I get really excited when I find them because they are from our aina. And we have some quartz crystals that you can find, but they are rare as diamonds.
And what about on the neighbor islands? Are there places you can go to that might have something a little unusual?
Well, what comes to mind is Kauai has very beautiful yellow calcite, and the Big Island has a lot of olivine, like the green sand beach everybody hears about. And olivine we actually have all over the island. And my favorite spot to go olivine hunting is Kaka'ako, because they brought in all these different lava stones from Lord knows where, and some of them have a lot of olivine in them.
Interesting. So now at the shows that you put together, what can people expect if our listeners haven't been to one?
Well, that's a really good question. We have this gem and mineral show coming up in June, actually June 1st and June 2nd. So that's kind of in 2 weeks, mm-hmm. The weekend in 2 weeks. And on June 1st, I need to say that's where I wrote it down. We are open from 11 to 8 p.m. and on June 2nd from 11 to 5 p.m. And to answer your question, what people can expect, we have, I want to say, we are very proud that we probably have the largest collection of diverse gem and minerals at our shows, because all of our club members have different passions. So we have club members who know a lot about turquoise. We have club members who know a lot about pearls. We have club members who know a lot about tourmaline. We have club members who know a lot about opal. And of course, the stuff they collect and they also sell is often linked to their passion. Me personally, I like quartz crystals a lot. Therefore, I have a lot of quartz crystals at my booth. And you can find we have over 24 club members that will offer stuff to the public. So there is a large assortment of things you can find.
Well, I know with my kids growing up, I finally had to institute a rule, no rocks and sticks in my car anymore, because we were just overloaded.
If we would go to my car, we could probably find easily 20 to 25 stones if I looked under the seats and in the little boxes that are in the back and the empty coffee container that I filled something with.
So your wife doesn't have a rule, no rocks and sticks in the car?
I think my wife has given up.
Okay. Well, now this year you're changing venue, right?
Yeah. This year we are for the first time at the Ohana Hale Marketplace, which is in Good Local where the Sports Authority used to be.
On Ward
Avenue, right next to Ross. And I'm very excited about this location. And there are sort of, for me, a bunch of really great advantages. One is people know it. The second great advantage is there is parking at Ward, although some people would question that. There is also the big concrete parking structure that's at the corner of Ward and Oahu Street from the former Ward warehouse that is also covered.
Right, nearby parking.
Very nearby parking. The third thing that for me is really exciting, it is very wheelchair accessible, because it is all sort of totally flat on the ground floor. And personally, I think ideally all venues in Hawaii should be this way, that they are easily wheelchair accessible, not just kinda, but easily.
And you've held the shows in Waikiki in previous years.
We had, I think 17 shows at the Outrigger by the beach in Waikiki in October. So we have one annual show in October, which this year we will have again, but we are still not sure which venue we will choose. And this is an additional show, the Hawaii Gem and Mineral Show now in June.
Okay, so just you're testing it out.
We are testing a new location that I really like, because what I hear the most from my friends is, I would have loved to come to your show, but you know, Waikiki and
parking, et cetera,
all the reservations most of us and all the listeners have as well. It's a very easy venue to get to, and we also have a website. And since I'm the webmaster, I kind of should mention that. And it is rockandmineralsocietyofhawaii.org in one word. It's all these words together. And we also have a map there on how to find it. And I remember this was 3 or 4 years back. I talked with a woman. She had flown in from Maui. She read about it on Greg's List, and she was so excited that there was a mineral show where she didn't have to fly to the U.S. or to Canada to go to, that she flew over just for our event.
Okay, so people might be surprised at the variety of things that you have on display. Just because your members are rabid collectors.
We are all collectors, and many of us go to other places. There's one huge mineral show in Tucson, Arizona, where a whole bunch of our members, including me, go to supply us with minerals. And of course, formally, we only buy to sell at our shows. But of course, our collections also happen to increase quite a bit when we go to other rock and mineral shows.
You just can't help yourself.
I just can't help myself, no.
What's the value of minerals, you know, versus gemstones that you get in pricey jewelry?
Well, I think part of it is personal preference. And gemstones are cut, and they have, for a lot of people, a different appeal. I'm personally a mineral collector, and the thought that somebody would take a totally beautiful mineral that has been formed by nature and is gorgeous and cut it in pieces and polish it and sell it, because it fetches a price that is probably 100 times more than a mineral. So from the financial side, I can understand it, gives me goosebumps. But then there are the people who love cut stones and who love gemstones and think I'm very silly.
Gosh, anything else you want to share just about rocks and minerals and what makes you guys just geeky about it?
Well, I of course hope that people come to our gem and mineral show, because it is a very unique event. And also the Ohana Hale Marketplace, I think, is a very interesting venue for us, because it has, for example, a lot of food booths, and it has also coffee that is supposedly very good. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And one added benefit, which I also wanted to say, on Saturday morning, there is the Kaka'ako Farmers Market, which is just around the corner from us. So you could go and you could pick up some local produce, and then you could come by and look at local vendors that sell you rocks and minerals from all over the world. And my personal favorite, but that's my bias, are the kids, because kids love rocks and minerals. And I remember I had a show a couple of years ago where I said to the dad, you should really go and have a coffee, because I saw that his son was totally into it. And he wasn't sure. And I said, you know, we're a whole bunch of people here. That's fine. Go over there. It's only, you don't see us from there, but go get the coffee and come back. And half an hour later, he looked at me with a very sad face and said, gosh, I should have really listened to you. So kids sometimes get so into it that it is totally enjoyable, because they have fabulous questions, and they love colors and they love shapes. And I love to answer questions from little curious minds.
Okay, so hopefully there'll be a lot out there. June 1st and 2nd.
Yes, June 1st and 2nd at the Ohana Hale Marketplace. Okay. And again, just to repeat it, June from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. and on June 2nd from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. because I think Sunday everybody wants to go home early.
Okay, all right. Well, thanks so much. This was fun.
Thank you very much.
That was Marcus Feigley of the Hawaii Rock and Mineral Society, Hui Pohaku o Hawaii, talking about the upcoming show here in Honolulu, the first weekend in June.
In rural areas across America, many hospitals are struggling to stay open.
They just don't have as many patients coming through the door as other geographic areas may have, and so that can be problematic.
I'm Amy Scott. What's a town to do when its hospital closes? That's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, right after All Things Considered.
That is it for today. Up tomorrow, Maui's long-awaited car rental facility opens to the public. We check in on the latest. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave us a comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.